Hello and welcome to another episode of Django Chat. In this episode, we're joined by Kojo Idrisa to talk about his multiple roles in the Python and Django communities. I'm Will Vincent. I'm joined by Carlton Gibson.
Hello.
And Kojo, welcome to the show.
Hello, everybody. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, we're thrilled to have you on.
Thank you for coming on, Kojo.
Where to start? I would start with, I think anyone who goes to regular Python or Django conferences in person knows who you are. You're a very big presence on that scene. But I don't know how much that translates to everyone else. So I hope in this show we can talk about all the work you do for the community and highlight some of those things. But maybe I'll just start with something fun that I found, which is that you and I both have MBAs, which is unusual.
Yeah.
And we both got into Python in 2012, which is that correct?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's when I sort of first decided to become more serious about becoming better at Python. I first dabbled with Python, I can't even remember, probably 1998, like Python 1.52. That's the first time I really saw it.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And started to play with it. But as you said, we both have MBAs. Before I got my MBA, I had a degree in accounting. And so as an accountant, I didn't need to be able to write code. And so it was something I played with a little bit here and there. But it was 2012 when I decided to be more serious about learning, becoming a better developer and trying to make a career change. So,
can I ask, that's really interesting, like the jump from business to programming, because it's almost like stereotypically people jump from programming into business or management or something like that. So I could ask both of you, what's the motivation to jump into programming? What's the motivation for that career change?
So I will say for myself, I think some of it was I just had an interest in programming for a long time. I had an interest in writing code. Some of it also was just recognizing my own personality traits. I am interested in building things. I'm interested in, I tend to have a forward-looking personality. And working mostly, I work primarily as an accountant. I've also worked as a university instructor. Working as an accountant, a lot of what I was doing was financial accounting. And so that's very sort of backwards looking. It's like, okay, let's look at what happened last month, or let's look at what happened last year, that kind of thing. And that just didn't really fit. I was more interested in looking forward. And so it was a combination of those things. And then also some of it was the accounting work, especially in my last accounting job. You've got a lot of data to work with, and there are things that can be automated and can be improved. And so, there was a sort of a convenient test bed there as far as things to work with. So,
and you started, you started by using Python to automate a number of your spreadsheets, right? Was that one of the first on the job or, at work projects that you use Python for?
Yeah. Yeah. So one of the early projects that I did was there was a manual task involving Excel that involved, making a pivot table, then a lot of filter copy paste, and then spend about 8 or 9 hours doing that. And I was like, well, this is dumb. And at that point, this was maybe mid-2013. By that point, I learned enough Python that I knew, okay, if I could actually just get my hands on this data, I can make this go faster. And just started installing development stuff on my laptop. So here now, I'll add a disclaimer that there are choices that I make that may or may not be right for everyone based on your risk profile. The decision I made was I'm going to start writing code until I get caught and fired. And I wasn't super worried about that happening because, if someone came and quote unquote caught me, it wasn't as if I was like writing a game or something. I was actually trying to automate the production of a monthly report, that we used at work and make that faster. But you never know how people will respond at a company. So that's just sort of the approach that I took as far as having a project to work on. And I eventually ended up just quitting that job because the company was having all sorts of problems and going on to try to focus on becoming a professional developer.
That's super. It's like the perfect story of development and automation and what programming is all about. And I'm always like, everyone should program. And everyone's like, we don't all need professional programs. I'm like, no, you don't need to write compilers, but almost every job out there you can do things where you're automating the manual tasks.
And actually, so I'm keynoting PyGotham in October, and the talk thank you. The talk I'm giving there sort of touches on, it's called the Python Spectrum, and it touches on the fact that there's a range of people who will use Python. Some of them will be, at one end of the spectrum, I have the software engineer, who's sort of what we think of as the stereotypical professional programmer. And at the other end of the spectrum is what I call a programmer, which is someone who writes code to solve their own problems, but they might not need all the tools that the software engineer uses. But all the people, and then, you know, and you, there's a wide range there in between, but all those people are using Python to solve a problem. So,
so you mentioned PyGotham. How do you attend so many conferences? Because you were at every conference I can think of and then some. What you haven't been doing that for forever, right? I think that's since 2017. Can you talk about how you do that, why you do that?
Okay, so I'll start with the why first, because the how is just I am probably a cautionary tale and you shouldn't be like me. The why is when I became more seriously, more actively involved in the Python community. This was, again, maybe around 2013. I decided that I wanted to be able to make a contribution in some way. And as someone who didn't have like a CS background and not a lot of experience programming, I knew it wasn't going to be a contribution by writing all the wicked code, you know, from day one. So I felt I could make a contribution by helping to grow the community, and more specifically by trying to grow the number of contributors in the community. And so most of the talks that I've given have had that as an underlying theme. I haven't always done the best job of bringing that to the surface, but that's sort of the idea. So the first conference talk I gave, the first talk I gave at a local meetup and the first conference talk I gave, it was in 2013. And it was around that project that I built to automate that spreadsheet task at my last accounting job. And the idea there was, if you want to grow contributors in the Python community, the people that you've got a larger group to choose from. You can either try to convert existing programmers who use some other language to Python programmers and try to get them to contribute, or you can turn non-programmers into programmers and try to get those people to contribute. The non-programmer population much larger than the existing programmer population. And the existing programmer population already has their own, you know, predilections, and they already like Java or C# or whatever they're using. And so the idea of that talk was, one, me talking about this project that I built, but also, two, pointing out that people who weren't programmers could be inspired to join the Python community because Python could actually benefit them. If you can demonstrate, well, you know, lots of people have to deal with spreadsheets. And so if you can demonstrate, here's a way, here's something that you can use to make your life easier, you're more inclined to try to use Python. And then that leads you into to wanting to potentially contribute. And so that's been the ongoing theme. And like even in the talk that I give at PyGotham, the idea is that to have contributors to the Python community, there are two requirements. One, someone who uses Python to solve problems for themselves, so they see some value in it. And then two, those people have to feel like they're actually members of the community. Because without those two things, no one's going to spend their time or effort to make contributions. So that's sort of a long-winded version of an answer to the why question. Why do I do all this? And that's why I became a DragonCon organizer, why I joined the board of DEFNA for a while, why I created and became the DEFNA North American ambassador, why I created the orientation thing at DragonCon US. All those things tie back to that common thread of wanting to grow the number of contributors in the community. A certain amount of a focus on inclusion there, because if you're trying to grow contributors in the community, you want to draw from as many segments of the population as possible. That only happens if you actually have an inclusive, yep, you know, community culture. So those are all sort of the whys. The hows are basically the why has caused me to sort of optimize my life around trying to do certain things. So I'm going to all these conferences here recently, since 2017 or so, because when I ran for the board of DEFNA, DEFNA is the Django Events Foundation North America. I think you all have talked about them before on the podcast. That's the nonprofit that puts on DjangoCon US. When I ran for the DEFNA board, I guess essentially my platform was to focus on the NA, the North America, in that, and trying to get more involvement from the non-US portions of North America, initially Canada and Mexico, but also the Caribbean. In that role, I made myself the DEFNA North American ambassador to try to build community across North America, initially primarily to let people know that with DjangoCon US, it can happen in any North American city. I don't know that people are aware of that. And so as I would submit talks to different conferences, I would also speak to the conference organizers and let them know, well, hey, in a few years, when, you know, we know what DjangoCon is going to be for these next few years, but after that, it could be in any North American city. So at Pi Tennessee, hey, Nashville, you know, it could be here. At, you know, at Pi Gotham, you could be here. At Pi Ohio, hey, Columbus could be here. Pi Caribbean, it could be in you know, anywhere in North America, it could be there. So that was sort of the motivation behind becoming the North American ambassador and then doing all the travel. And again, back to that idea of trying to create more contributors to the community. The how is just, I just sort of make it happen. I'm using a lot of vacation days and like, so I call it NORAMGT, and I use the hashtag sometimes on Twitter. The North American Grand Tour is what I'm sort of doing. But it is almost entirely self-funded. And so, so it's just a matter of me sort of using vacation days, using some conference. I'm able to use conference days in a few limited spots, but for the most part, it's just me using my vacation days and footing the bill for the travel and the accommodation myself. So just trying to go to as many places as I can and trying to sort of maximize coverage, as it were, because there are certain parts of North America that aren't as involved or aren't always as included. And so like I've spoken to PyCaribbean twice. I spoke at Python Day Mexico. I will almost definitely be going to the first PyCon LATAM in August. I mean, just sort of trying to do that. But then I've also gotten a little carried away and I've been to other continents. I'm supposed to be focusing on North America, but it's sort of it's morphed from me being I think the initial intention was for me to be the ambassador from DefNet to North America. But at some point I have become the ambassador from North America to the rest of the world. So yeah, so I'm gonna have to try to dial that back a little bit because, you know, there are limits to, you know, time and money and to energy. So trying to balance that all out.
Well, energy is important because I find going to a conference really hard work, you know, like it's fun, it's fantastic, but it's draining. So you're doing that in your vacation. So I always think, oh, well, when I get back, I need a couple of days off to recover and rebuild my energy, but you're back to work.
it's sometimes directly back to work. I think when I came back from Pi, I spoke at PyCon Australia last year. And so I got a direct flight from Sydney back to Houston. It was a 16-hour flight, 16-hour time difference. So I got on the plane like Wednesday morning at 9, landed in Houston Wednesday morning at 9:30, and then just drove from the airport to work. So that's been a thing at times. So just sort of having to manage my energy and try to be a little more cognizant of things. Like I literally, like about a few hours ago, I had to, you know, let one conference know that I wasn't going to be able to attend just because of the way the scheduling was going to work out. I'd be traveling almost every week or every other week for like a 2-month period, and just, you know, between, you know, money and personal resources and energy, you know, there's only so much of that you can do. So
wow. Yeah. I remember too, and maybe since you've been to so many conferences, I noticed, so I've only been to two real conferences in my life. One was DjangoCon last year and the other was PyCon this year. And I found that PyCon was way more overwhelming.
And PyCon this year, and I've had this conversation with multiple people. I just had this conversation with a friend a week or so ago. PyCon 2019, for some reason, seemed like it was a little more chaotic or overwhelming, not chaotic as far as unorganized, but just like there was more going on than PyCon 2018, the same venue, same place. But I talked to a number of people and we all sort of had the same experience of, oh, like I didn't really get to see as many people. I would see people that I knew, but they were like way over there. And there were a lot of people in between us. Whereas in the same venue with roughly the same number of people in 2018, that didn't seem to be the case. So, but yeah, there's a lot happening at PyCon.
Yeah. Well, I mean, PyCon's, five times the size. And I mean, the venue actually in Cleveland's unbelievable because the hotels are there. Everything is right there.
Yeah.
But I think, yeah, I just, you know, curious about your experience. I mean, I think partly too, I spoke at DjangoCon. So I was in and out, and I was also very wrapped up in my talk. Whereas at PyCon, I didn't have a talk. So I was sort of, what do I do? You know, I almost felt like felt like if I wasn't having a meal with someone new every time, I wasn't quite, making the most of it.
Yeah.
But for you though, I mean, you're often speaking though, right? So you're in a very public facing role. You're not really there just to soak it all up at this point.
Yeah. It's, and it varies a little bit. So let's see. With PyCon, I've never actually spoken to PyCon. I did, last year I led an open space, and then in 2017, I believe I gave a lightning talk. But I've never actually given like, you know, a full on PyCon talk. At most of the other conferences I go to, I'm giving a talk, and that's, it makes it a little bit easier to justify the expense if I'm actually giving a talk, and then doing some of the community building stuff. But then at DjangoCon, I have like three chairs for DjangoCon, and almost all of them are public facing things. And so that's just sort of a thing. PyCon is much bigger than almost anything else, you know, most people would go to. And so it can be a lot. There's a lot going on there.
So we've talked about Python and Django sort of interchangeably. How did you, I'm always curious, since it was somewhat recently, how did you learn Django? What was that process like for you? Because I imagine I remember what it was like. So for you, what was that process like as an adult learning Django?
So for me, and I guess it's still sort of an ongoing process. I'm actually really trying to spend more time working on Django. I don't do as much Django as I'd like. I tell people I'm much better at organizing Django Con than I am at, you know, building things in Django. And so I'm trying to sort of balance that out a little bit. But I think I really started with the Django Girls tutorial. I'm trying to remember like what inspired me. I think it was more a matter of, I had submitted a talk to Django Con and I was going to be speaking there and I just wanted to be more familiar with it. So that's one of the things I did. And I ended up being a Django Girls coach. And now I'm trying to work on some other projects to just familiarize myself with Django more. It's been sort of an on and off process. I spend more time using just regular Python than I do with Django, but I know that's an area where I want to improve. So
I feel like I'm the opposite. I mean, Carlton, I'd like you to weigh in. I mean, I feel like I'm pretty comfortable with Django, but the amount of pure Python that I do is actually not, well, it doesn't feel like that much. I think it is because I just use the same things over and over again. But, you know, to the extent I have expanded learning time, there's a lot of things I want to build with Python, especially around async, whereas I'm within the Django world most of the time. So I guess there's always that feeling as a developer of there's something else I should be learning, you know, so I have that with pure Python, I would say, actually.
But that's a life project, right? Programming is a life project. And that's what's so good, nice about it is, you know, if you're the kind of person that finds that logical challenge of programming fun and you can cope with the fact that computers are really particular, then, you know, there's always the new framework, the new language, and it's never ending. It's like it's brilliant. It's this garden that you just keep picking.
Well, and I think also everyone, you know, everyone learns and everyone teaches differently, which is why I love asking that question, because I find that however my mind works, almost none of the existing things match my mind for how I think about, you know, things in Django and how I would teach it, which is why, you know, if I thought that someone had already done the canonical job on a subject that fit my brain, I would do it. But my brain is how it is. And that's why I always tell people sometimes other developers will say, oh, I'm working on a Django thing and feel like I would be worried about that. And I think, no, like everyone should write and teach because everyone learns differently and there's not one style for everyone. But for me, it's like it's sort of that learning cycle. Maybe I'm a little more negative about it, Carlton. I just feel like I'm like, I know what I want it to do. Why won't it do it? And then once I figure it out, I'm almost kind of angry that it took me so long to get there, right? Like I have a long list of all these things. I'm like, I want future me, it's like Calvin Hobbes, future me to do this and tell me how to do it because I know that there is an elegant solution and I will find it and then I'll be bored with it. But sometimes I'm like, I just want it, which, you know, Kojo, to your point, like I come to programming, it's a tool for me. Like I wouldn't just code for fun. Like I play music for fun, but I wouldn't code for fun.
Yeah.
It's very much, Carlton looks hurt. You know, it's very.
Well, no, like you've got to have something you actually want to build. Yeah, you can't just like sit there doing programming cones, but you've got something you want to build.
Well, that's
and
the context
fun,
problem, right? This is what, you know, as a teacher, I always start with the context, you know, so because the standard CS programming things that engineers love to do, which I envy, you know, output numbers from 1 to 100, make a pyramid, all these things. I don't care. It just doesn't, connect with me at all.
I'm similar in that. And I think that's one of the reasons that one of the things that drew me to Django and one of the reasons I am wanting to improve my abilities to build web applications, because I think if you're trying to show people or demonstrate the usefulness of programming, yes, there are things that you can do with just sort of standard Python scripts. But if you build a web application of some sort, even like a blog or something, even something that's simple that just like, you know, a Django thing that just says hello world, if you get that deployed somewhere, then like you can show, you know, the person who built that can show it to their friends, to their family. It's like, look, I made a thing and it exists in the real world. As opposed to like, hey, let me bring you my laptop and open this virtual environment and show you how the script runs. It's like, well, hey, no, just go to... you know, go to fancykojo.pythonanywhere.com and you'll see, you know, the fancy thing that I made because I'm fancy.
Yeah. Well, it's those aha moments. That's how I think of them is you need to have them. You got to start with them saying, we're going to have one, we'll get there. And then especially, the web is fantastic because you can share it. And as you said, it's, you know, people feel good coming out of whatever tutorial. But then I always tell people like, like really share this link with some friends or family. And that's, I think, when it goes, wow, like people can see what you've done and it makes it real.
And I've actually, I think you and I met, Will, at DjangoCon last year. And so I haven't gotten around to it, but I've been meaning to take a look at your books as far as, because I'm always, as someone whose career changed, I spend a certain amount of time, like I'm active in our Pi Ladies chapter here, and then there's another female-centric coding group here that I'm involved with. And so I end up meeting, and even at our standard Python meetup, I end up meeting a lot of people who are like learning to code for different reasons, some who are trying to career change. So I'm always looking at different materials as far as, okay, how can someone learn, you know, Python or Django? And so, Ian, I've heard good things about your books, and I know you've got them updated like for Python 2.0, Django 2.1, I believe.
2.2. I'm the only 2.2 one out there.
Now. Okay. Yeah. So there you go. And so
I'm very up to date.
I keep meaning to take a look at your books because it seems like you've also got an interesting range of things. But from the question of how do people learn Django, there are a lot of different ways to go about it. So that's another resource that I want to evaluate at some point because I get asked those sorts of questions in your so.
Yeah, it comes back to what you were saying at the beginning, Kojo, about like bringing in the beginners into the Python community. I think Django is a really good, like the web is the tool. It's the publishing medium of now. And Django is a really great framework for beginners and for everybody. But if we can really focus on spreading that story, it's a self-fulfilling circle.
And,
right?
And so the talk I'm doing at PyGotham, it's interesting. I gave a version of that talk here at my local Python meetup, and it ended up being more contentious than I expected. Basically, software engineers kind of want everybody to do things the software engineering way. And one of the reasons I gave that talk is because I've seen situations where, so the general Python community culture seems to be heavily skewed towards software engineering being the one true way of writing code. And I have definitions of sort of what do I mean by software engineering and what do I mean by programming? And, you know, I won't go into all the details, but basically software engineering usually done in teams. It's usually a situation where the code is the final product, the people running the code aren't the people who wrote it. With programming, it's almost the exact opposite. Almost always done by individuals. The person running the code is the person who wrote it. And no one really cares about the code. You care about the output. And so you've got different use cases, different constraints. So all software engineers are programmers, but all programmers aren't software engineers and don't need to be and don't aspire to be. And so that talk ended up being a little bit contentious, but the sort of the undercurrent of that is that if we want more contributors in the community, we can't have the software engineers who are sort of seen as the authority figures and the more experienced people telling the programmers that they're doing it wrong because like they don't, you know, because they don't have a Travis account or because, you know, they're not using Docker. Yeah. Unless that programmer has a specific use case where it's like, oh, you know what, here's this problem you're running into, you know, having continuous integration would solve that, or you know, having you know, using Git would solve that, or what have you. And so, again, trying to maximize the potential number of contributors because it's an open source project. Python and Django are both open source projects. We need as much help as we can. Russell Keith McGee gave an excellent keynote at PyCon this year where he touched on that. I mean, he's spoken about that kind of thing a lot, and the idea of you know. If there's money, I mean, yourself, Carlton, and you're the Django fellow, one of the Django fellows, if there is funding available, you can pay people to work on these projects instead of having to rely entirely on volunteers. But even with that, people who have skills, you know, that we could pay them money to make use of, those people have options. And so, like, you know, I could get paid money to work on Python or Django, or I could get paid money to work on some other thing. If every time I use Python or Django, the people in that community are like, hey, you're doing it wrong. Well, like, why am I going to spend my time working on this? I can get paid the same amount of money to go work on something else where people actually value what I'm doing and aren't telling me I'm wrong. And so, you know, it's sort of wanting to try to bring out the idea of maximizing the range of contribution that we can get from that spectrum. Because again, everyone doesn't have to be a software engineer. There are lots of people who use Python that could potentially become contributors, but we have to make sure that we're including those people in our community discussions and that we're not telling them wrong because they're not quote unquote full-fledged software engineers.
Yeah, no, entirely.
We agree. So something else I wanted to touch upon is, so Django itself is going through a change in core contributors. I know you've written about this. I'm wondering if you could share your your perspective on, you know, what's your take on where you'd like to see the Django core, or what's thought of as core, go moving forward?
I mean, I've spoken about it a little bit, but I don't know that I have super strong feelings on it from the standpoint of, I mean, definitely, I think in a very short sense, there's always going to be a very small percentage of people who are actually involved in like building the core language and or the core framework and contributing to it. I mean, and that's just sort of the reality of things, the reality of open source. But again, trying to, so no matter what you do, there's always going to be a very small, like of the number of people who use Django, you know, compared to, you know, if you have like the bottom number is the number of people who use Django, the top number is the number of people who actually contribute to it. That top number is always going to be an infinitesimally small fraction of the bottom number. I think my concern is more being able to draw from a wider pool for that top number, for that contributor number, because that just gives you a number of different benefits from the standpoint of, you know, different viewpoints, different coverage. You know, you've got a variety of thoughts and inputs and that sort of thing. So beyond sort of general thinking, I haven't given a whole lot of thought or attention to the changes in Django Core, like partially because I've been busy being the North American ambassador. And so, you know, I've been sort of like wandering the continent and / planet, talking to people about DjangoCon, you know, partially because I feel that like if people are in, especially at least throughout North America, are aware that DjangoCon US could come to their North American city, then I think that increases some of the buy-in. It's like, oh, wait, because for instance, that's not the case with PyCon. PyCon is big enough where it can only go to certain places. Whereas with DjangoCon, with DjangoCon US, we want those CFPs, you know, once that process is open, we want to hear that input from different people in different places. And as different local communities become more engaged, if they realize, hey, you know what, DjangoCon US could come here, then I think that drives more engagement, and that sort of engagement and involvement will draw more people in, whether it be to the conference or to contributing to Django itself.
I imagine that's similar, Carlton, in Europe with DjangoCon Europe, where there's also a desire. I mean, because it also does, or at least recently, what, 2 years in one place and then moves from there?
No, DjangoCon Europe has moved
every year. Okay,
every I think. The issue is very much like trying to plan a year in advance, 2 years in advance. Okay, where can we host it? And it's only 500. It's not even 500 people. 350 people. So it could go anywhere. It's finding the team that want to. And I'm just thinking about what Kojo's saying about getting contributors, because it's something I've spoken about and beat the drum for, widening the contributors. I think you're right, there will always be a small number, and we see more perhaps coming in, we see fresh contributors, but, oh, that's exciting. But it's still, what I'm still not seeing is many non-white males. And white males are great, but there are lots of people in the Django community who don't fit that profile, and we don't see so many of those people contributing, and it would be really nice. Even if it's only like two pull requests, you know, one change to the doc, one anything, but like come and join in, because people are welcome, and we try and be supportive, and we still have barriers, and to knock those down is kind of like, my tick. If I've got a tick, is I want to really help try and smooth that on ramp, because historically it's not been.
Yeah, exactly. And I think with the things that I do, I make an effort to try to help some of that on ramp. One, by, so with the things that we do, like at DjangoCon US specifically, you know, the orientation session is designed to sort of to, you know, help create a more welcoming environment. And then, you know, so that while you're at DjangoCon, you can, you know, feel like you're more a part of the community. And the other organizers also work very hard to have that that inclusion culture at DjangoCon US. The reality is some people, you know, are off put by some of that. Some people want just like 100% purely hardcore technical, you know, super advanced Django, you know, tips and tricks. The reality is, and I've talked to people about submitting talks to DjangoCon. DjangoCon is three things. It is an open source web application framework written in Python. And so the open source part really means that it's a community-driven thing, almost entirely volunteer-driven. And so you have to take care of the community so that the project can continue to live. I think it was Jacob Kaplan-Moss who said in one of his talks, any community that's not tended to, you know, that's not, you know, you tend to be looked after, tends towards toxicity. And so there's a certain amount of effort that's required to maintain the quality of the community in the community culture. And that means sometimes at conferences for open source projects, there are going to be talks about community and about things like burnout and mental health and that sort of thing, because members, that's how you keep the members of the community strong. And so, you know, so there's that, absolutely. But then there's also the idea of, you know, trying to sort of share the idea that DjangoCon US could come to a different city. And just as you get more people involved, it draws in more people who could be potential contributors. And if you make that group, you know, not focusing just on, like, you know, cis hetero white men between 25 and 45, then you get these different viewpoints and different insights that you might not have seen otherwise. And then that makes the software better. It makes it applicable to a wider range of situations, and it just makes, you know, the overall experience better. So,
well, I think DjangoCon this year is doing it. I like the structure where the 3 days of talks, they have the first 2 days are, I guess, general talks, and then the third day is advance what used to be Django under the hood. That seems like a really nice structure of it, because it does remove some confusion. And I mean, Carlton, you're speaking on the third day. I'm speaking, I think, on the second day, because my talk is a little more beginner intermediate. That seems, you know, that's a nice structure for people to understand.
Yeah. And I think some of that comes from feedback we've gotten from folks as far as, you know, wanting, you know, some of the more detailed advanced things. And so the reality is, I'm this sort of bizarre outlier. I know a lot of, and again, as someone who's been to a lot of conferences, I've spoken to a lot of people at conferences, and most people don't go to conferences unless, like, their company is paying for it. I'm one of the few people that I know who just goes to conferences because I'm going to a conference, or, you know, or just submits talks to conferences just because. And so most people either won't go or can't go unless they're getting it paid for by their company. And then there needs to be some sort of business case. You know, or and you've got people who are entrepreneurs and that sort of thing, who are, you know, running their own one or two person Django shop. And so they want, you know, it's sort of as much like meat, for lack of a better term, as they can get. And so something like this sort of, you know, Django under the hood ish day helps to fill that need.
Also, I think that the point you touched on previously was right. And we shouldn't let them back us down on the point that the non-technical talks are just as important. Because, for instance, I went to DjangoCon Europe in Florence, and there was a whole host of talks on cognitive bias and on diversity and inclusion in your design teams and how that makes the product better. And you're just like, yeah, this is right. You know, if you have a diversity hire, you actually widen the perspective of your team, which makes you capable of creating better software. And any business owner sitting in that audience who took that to heart would go home and have make a better hiring decision and have a stronger team because of that, and their business would profit. And I think it's a tendency to say, oh, well, because they're not technical talks, there's not as much value in the conference. No, there's more value in the conference.
Well, I think also technical talks, it's easy to assume that something that's advanced is harder to do or provides more benefit, when I often think they're actually a lot more narrow and in some ways a lot easier to do, because you don't have time to start up from the beginning. You just sort of parachute into an existing complex project that makes sense to you, the speaker, and maybe a handful of people in the audience, but everyone else you've sort of lost. Whereas it's these general talks. I mean, Carlton, we first connected. You gave a talk on, you know, life as a programmer of a certain age, which we both are. You know, that's a timeless talk. That's not going to get old. You know, that resonates more than, you know, some discrete, tiny technical issue. And I think, Kojo, your efforts, and I hope this podcast as well, shows that the Django, the Python community, is not just experts in their little shell throwing eggs at stuff. I mean, there's some of that, but it's people who really want to help, and having all these experiences and voices helps everyone understand what it's like, because we all just trapped in our own head. I mean, for me, as an educator, one of the challenges I've had is that as my knowledge of Django has increased, I lose touch a little bit with what the true beginner mindset is like, because when I wrote my first book, when I started writing it, I was a beginner. But I do that by doing literally dozens of emails every day. So that's sort of how I get that touch point. And it just provides the empathy that helps any community. It helps me be better at my job. I think helps anyone be good at their job as a programmer. Because, for example, even an advanced person often just thinks, well, everyone knows XYZ, or they just don't think that it's hard because they've never experienced trying to show it to someone else. So if you think something's easy, try to teach it to someone. Like, try to teach someone how to install Python on a Windows machine.
Yeah, I've noticed that with programming in sort of, you know, knowledge of Django or Python, it's very much like understanding a person's level with a spoken language. The idea of, like, it's hard to know, like, okay, well, so for instance, like, I lived in China for 2.5 years. I speak conversational Mandarin, but, like, how much Mandarin do I speak? It's hard to communicate that to someone as far as, like, you know, how much vocabulary do I have? What grammatical things do I know? And so once you get beyond sort of, like, here's a talk for beginners who don't know Python. Okay, now I'm going to do an intermediate talk for people who know, like, some Python or some Django.
Yeah.
Well, but how much do they know and what specific things do they know? It's difficult. And so you have to make certain assumptions and decide what are you going to explain in detail versus what are you going to assume that the audience knows. And so that can be tricky.
Well, we had Nicholas Tollervey on, who's very active in Python Django, and he's working on a project, Code Grades, that for schools, but also sort of similar to the music curriculum, lets people say, oh, I'm a grade 3, I'm a grade 5, because I agree. I think part of the problem is people just don't know what context to describe something to someone else. And for me as an educator, I always start from the beginning, work my way up, and I'll go faster if it's a more advanced topic. But I feel it's a massive disservice not to go through all the steps, even if it's quickly going through it, because you just parachute in. And I can't follow a lot of tutorials if someone just jumps in and says, oh, you got a basic blog here. It's like, well, there's so many different ways you could do that blog and so many things that compound, but it's a ton of work. I mean, I speak from experience. It's a ton of work for me every single time I do a tutorial or something to just, like, start from the bare basics. And most people don't do the work.
Yeah, I'm about halfway through that episode, actually, in the middle of listening to it. So, yeah. And I face the same thing. A lot of the talks I've given have been more beginner/intermediate. But I do that because, again, my emphasis is on trying to help bring new contributors into the community. And so I tend to focus on that sort of range. But I know that as I move into more intermediate talks, there's this idea of needing to define, okay, what do I expect you to know? If I'm not going to start from the beginning, what do I expect you to know or to be familiar with? And trying to outline that up front so that people can decide, okay, is this a talk I'm going to get something out of or not?
Right. Well, and there's that new to me trap that I've,
exactly.
It's sort of like, well, why give a talk on something you already know? It's much more common to, you know, keep pushing your own boundaries of expertise. So something else, Kojo, you recently won the Malcolm Trudnick Award. Could you speak a bit about what that award is?
So I guess I can probably speak a little more about what it is as opposed to how it's awarded. Okay, I was sort of surprised. I was surprised myself to find out about it. So the award is, and now I feel like I'm sort of doing it a disservice by not being able to read the exact description, but it basically is an award that goes to someone who has done a great job or has been seen to do a great job in welcoming new members into the community. And I don't know that I was familiar with the award until I won it. And then when, you know, I found out that I won it, I read the description and I was like, oh, like, this is, like, kind of what I've been trying to do. And so I was ecstatic. I was like, okay, I couldn't be any more happy with having won this award, because this is, you know, a lot of what I've been trying to do since I came into the Python community. And then I know a few people who have won the award before me, and so it's a good company to be in. And so, unfortunately, I was never able to meet Malcolm. I didn't become active into the Django community until after he had passed away. But all the descriptions that I have heard about him, and I know a few people, more than a few people who know him and have met him. And so it was very, very rewarding to receive the prize. So that's something I'm fairly proud of. I try to maintain a certain sort of level-headedness and a level of perspective, but, you know, it is something I'm proud of. So,
yeah, well, you should be. So for listeners who want to get in touch, what's the best way for folks to do that?
So for me, probably Twitter, one of the best ways. My Twitter handle is transition, just like the normal word, nothing fancy, just the word transition. That's the only social media that I have. I also have a blog, which is kojoidrisa.com. It is not terribly frequently updated. I'm working on trying to do a better job of that. And also trying to write a little bit more about the North American Grand Tour. It's something I've been doing it for now for the past almost 2 years, but I don't feel like I've done a great job of sort of explaining it to, you know, I think like there are like seven people who know what NORAM GT means. And so I need
to
do a
better job
of that.
Well, now there'll be over 1,000. So,
well, let's see. There you go. So if you see the hashtag NORAM GT on Twitter, that's me being on somewhere on the North American Grand Tour. But yeah, those are the best places to find me. Twitter, probably the best place to interact with me. So
thank you so much for coming on and sharing your story with us and with the community. It's really important work that you're doing, and I hope you get a little more recognition for it.
Thank you. Thank you all for having me. And thank you for the podcast. The podcast is excellent. Like I said, I've listened to just about all the episodes. I'm about halfway through the Nicholas Tolliver one. So it's been excellent.
Awesome. Thanks.
Thank you for coming on the show, Kojo.
Thank you.